Jillian Cannonball Adderley and his quintet with "This Here." He said it is to be pronounced "This Here." So there you go. I just did it, and I think I got it right. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrace Lead, and we are going to be picking up from where we left off, but not from the point of view that you think. We'll be talking something else. We won't know much until later tonight, the results of the Democratic Party's presidential primaries in six states: Michigan, Missouri, Mississippi, Idaho, North Dakota, and Washington State. But we'll be talking about that tomorrow. So we will be missing all of the late votes and the vote tallies because that will happen tonight. But we will return instead to yesterday's discussion focusing on Wall Street's nosedive and major factors that contributed to it. And we're still not out of the water yet on that count. Our guest is Charles Ortel, and you should know that name because we've been doing joint broadcasts for several years, as a matter of fact, specifically relating to the Clinton Foundation, and he continues. He hasn't been with us for a while, and that is because he's up to his eyeballs in research and traveling all over the world chasing documents, because he is continuing with his fastidious research and investigation into the Clinton Foundation. You may know that Charles Ortel was the person who took on General Electric and showed that the company was committing massive fraud. And then he quit Wall Street. He was a banker at Wall Street and decided that he will devote the rest of his productive years in exposing corporate fraud, especially in the area of charity fraud. And to that degree, he has done many shows with us talking about the Clinton Foundation and the extent of fraud that he has uncovered and is still uncovering. And he is proceeding with that as his new calling, his other calling in life, concentrating on institutional and charity fraud. So he's with us today because, as I said to you yesterday, I had no problem admitting it, the inner workings of Wall Street is not one of my strong points. I know just about as much as the average person knows. But it is important to understand how it came to be that we had this catastrophe looming just at the same time that the coronavirus was looming, that the president and questions about his leadership are looming, and it all came together in a perfect storm. So I thought the best person that I could find, this is a person I would go to myself, to just get an idea of what is in the background of all of this. How are these things linked together? And what in some parts of the world, you know, we see things because they are so apparent. But in other parts of the world, there are people who read things at a whole different level. And it is almost stunning what they see because we can't see it at all. But that was a very long introduction for you, Charles.
Well, thanks so much for having me back on, Yatrice. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
I should mention that you have begun to make waves yourself with your own program. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Thanks for bringing that up. I teamed up in June of 2017 with a Hollywood veteran who had done a lot of different things and different irregular and three-dimensional films to do a series of podcasts. We do two a week. On Sunday, we do Sunday Withdrawals, and on Wednesday, we do something called Closing In. And all told, we've done 215 two-hour podcasts so far, where we try to make them modestly amusing. We have a formula where each show we try to riff on a known movie or media product. We change the title slightly to make it, we think, funny. And then we talk through a topic in depth, typically having to do with charity fraud and the Clinton Foundation or some other related fraud. And we provide our viewers, it's all for free on Jason Goodman's YouTube channel. You can see there's a playlist of every single one of these. And with about 200 of them, there are pull-down slide presentations that give you tremendous backup information if you're interested in seeing the details of that explain my concerns about the Clinton Foundation and other frauds. So that's all free of charge. And Jason does many other shows. Actually, he does shows 7 days a week typically. And he's built up quite a thing. It's called Crowdsource the Truth. We have an active dialogue with our viewers who have been helping us bring the Clintons to justice and others to justice across the United States and around the world, which is a big job.
Now, when people would ask me, well, what happened to Charles Ortel? I said, he's working. He is working. He's up to his eyeballs and researching and investigating. Could you please let people know that I'm not lying?
You're not lying about this.
Very diplomatic.
Yes, but the approach that we took, that I and a team, now it's quite a large team of people around the world, we're all chipping in to help. And the approach we took is we realized that this had been covered up. That this being the fact that it's such an obvious set of frauds that even somebody as dopey as James Comey and Bob Mueller and Rod Rosenstein, even those three guys, would have known way back in 2001 through 5, when the Clinton Foundation was indeed investigated, they would have known that this was a fraud. And instead of doing something about it, evidently the establishment in Arkansas and the folks in Washington, D.C. said, this is such a big mess, we can't stop it. Let's just, let it get bigger and bigger, and let's let Barack Obama copy it, and let's let George W. Bush copy it, and George H.W. Bush, and we'll just set up this post-presidential life opportunity for the great public servants who inhabit the White House after they leave. And because when you dig into it and you check the rules, as I have done, and others have done, experts in accounting and tax and law, when you check what they should have done versus seeing what they did do, it is transparent for fraud. For example, most people who are not lawyers would say, if I said to you something was incorporated and I said something was organized, you would say that's the same thing. Well, in fact, it's not. So the Clinton Foundation, the original entity was called the William J. Clinton Presidential Foundation. It was incorporated at 11:22 in the morning on October 23, 1997. All that means is that in this case, three lawyers signed what are called articles of incorporation as incorporators, not as the original trustees, but as incorporators. And they did that and filed it in Little Rock that day, October 23, 1997. Now, two of the three lawyers who did this were very actively involved defending the Clinton bill in the impeachment process as it sprung to life thereafter, and had been, two of those lawyers had also been involved or a number of those lawyers had been involved very actively defending the Clintons against the various inquiries that sprang up the instant almost before Bill Clinton arrived as president on January 20th, 1993. So this very astute group of lawyers, and we're talking here about Williams and Connolly as one main law firm, which is, some would argue, the most powerful law firm in America because it's, you know, got such a stranglehold on Republicans and Democrats based in Washington, D.C., currently in power, formerly in power, destined to always be in power. So this is a very powerful law firm, and it couldn't do the essential thing of saying, listen, you know, lawyers do not create nonprofit corporations that become tax exempt. You have to have independent trustees, truly independent from the organization, put their names and their signatures on the line and then protect the interest of this nonprofit corporation from the political aims of people around it, from the personal enrichment aims of people around it. They have their honor band to do all that. And the record shows clearly that they did none of that. They did not adopt bylaws until 62 days after filing the incorporation papers on the 23rd of December, 1997. The bylaws are sloppy as, I'll just be, use a mild curse word, as heck. And they contradict the articles of incorporation. The application for federal tax exemption that was created by these lawyers or put in by these lawyers under a power of attorney is boldly defective. But of course,
well,
Bill's president,
you're going to go down this road and we will have used up our entire program talking about
right.
something that you should be back to spell out in painstaking detail, although you have done this before, but you have added more information because of the ongoing investigation that you are doing. But I want to kind of not have you go down there yet
okay.
until you're ready to just break everything right open. But suffice it to say, your investigations continue, and not just in the United States with regard to the Clinton Foundation, but all over the world, literally. You have been hopping back and forth and traveling and digging up papers. And I guess I could ask you the question in the shortest way possible. When will you be ready with this particular investigation?
Well, the approach we took is the government, the big government people like to talk about a whole of government approach. We took a whole of conspiracy approach. In other words, there are a large number of co-conspirators in this, and we decided that we would not be selective and that we would go after every single fraudster connected to this mess of frauds. And we've done that. In multiple states, there are proceedings that were started. In multiple countries, there are proceedings that have started. And one disturbing thing that I have found around the Clintons and frankly around the politicians is what they tend to do is they, when they actually have to do something, they go after the small fish. One example of that is there's a fellow called John Hope Bryant who is connected to this Clinton Foundation mess. He runs a number of nominal charities. One is called Operation Hope. Another is called Global Dignity. And actions have been taken against those charities by multiple parties. And I believe those actions are going to soon result in the involuntary revocation of the authority for those charities to operate, and lawsuits will commence and perhaps criminal penalties will attach. And I am determined that it, you know, on this fraud, we're not just going to put, as they did with Corinne Brown, on a charity fraud, we're not just going to go after African-American or minority people who've committed charity fraud. It happens this person is a minority. It happens this person, I believe, is connected to fraud. And if this person gets punished, then by God, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Chelsea Clinton absolutely must be punished, and even more severely, because they were people of power and privilege. They abused the system. They felt they could get away with it. They did get away with it for 23-plus years. If other people go down, they must go down and pay a bigger price, in my view, for the scales of justice to be rebalanced. And
okay.
I can't put it.
One last question before we move on to the topic at hand today.
Sure.
Could you just give people an idea of how much money you're talking
sure.
about associated with these frauds and the Clinton Foundation?
Well, when I, it's really, it's tough to call it a business model. I suppose you could call it a crime model or a fraud model. The fraud model, if you start with the Clinton frauds and then add on to them frauds that are emulating the Clintons, you get into the trillions of dollars. And you get, it's a business model, I believe, where these powerful people who sit atop typically governments or senior cabinet officials and leaders of countries, they get used to flying around in these fancy jets with their armed guards and fancy living. And when time comes to leave their jobs, they want to keep doing that, but it's extremely expensive. So there's developed, I think, this mutual admiration society of people all embracing globalism. You know, let's use foundations like the Clinton Foundation, the Barack Obama Foundation, and others like it to get these vast government grants to go after these amorphous causes that nobody checks. And, you know, it's just, unfortunately, when you add it all up, it's literally in the trillions of dollars. And we ordinary people who pay our taxes and believe that these leaders couldn't possibly be as corrupt as I think they now are, you know, we are the ones living in the dream world. They are the ones laughing all the way to the bank. I mean, you look at Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton admitted that they were dead broke when they left the White House. Today, they are worth in the hundreds of millions of dollars running a charity. I mean, that's just a... And others, Barack Obama had some money from writing some books. He wasn't as profligate while in the White House, but he too has gone from a modest fortune to a vast fortune, in part running a charity. This is not the way it's supposed to work. You're supposed to, if you have a lot of money, you're supposed to give it away responsibly. So it is, I think, sadly, Etrice, in the trillions of dollars.
People would never think that. They would think that this is just all made up. But let's get to our issue today. How do you explain? You were a Wall Street banker. You know the innards of Wall Street. From your perspective, what happened this week that brought the market almost to its knees?
Well, I think this is a process that's going to continue. So, simply put, when we think about our daily lives and we think about maybe investing in the market, the fact is that in the richest country on earth today, even with the market decline, the United States remains the richest country on earth. In this rich country, fewer than 20% of us actually buy and sell stocks directly. And depending on how you look at it, it's much less than that. So very few people, you know, are raised in a culture of saying, you know, it's a good idea to maybe spend less money than you earn. I mean, we've embraced this culture of debt. Debt is freely available. You want to go out and lease a car or buy a car with borrowed money, you can do that. You want to buy a house with borrowed money, you can do that. You want a credit card, you can do that. You want to borrow to go to college, you can do that. So we've had this period where, and it goes way back, I would say it certainly goes back to December 31st, 2008, arguably beforehand. Americans have grown accustomed to the idea of spending more than they earn. Now, you can only do that for so long. And it's we become in this country, the data is very good, and there's something called the Z1 statistics that are put out by the Federal Reserve. They're publicly available. They go back to 1945 on a consistent basis. And they show that after World War II, consumer borrowing was very, very low. The government had borrowed enormous sums of money relative to the output of the economy to help win World War II. But the average American back then didn't borrow. The average business didn't borrow. The average bank wasn't as leveraged. And as America reemerged on the world stage as a great place to park money, money just flowed towards the U.S. And we fortunately had a large number of projects that we wanted to pursue. So the society, you know, we built the interstate system, we built all sorts of projects, and we built and built and grew and exported until 1989 period. And that's when China decided to reject the path they had been on, impoverishing their people. India decided in 1995 to reject the path that they had been on. And all of a sudden, the world opened up. And instead of employing expensive people on world markets basis in New York City or in Los Angeles or you name it, suddenly capitalists had an opportunity to employ people who could do fantastic work for much less money in India and China and elsewhere. And so we had this monster imbalance between people willing to work at cut rate wages in these far-flung places and people inside the United States who've gotten very comfortable in a relatively protected and insulated market. So there, I'm simplifying, but there ensued a long period where jobs just flew outside the United States. Factories were shut. We see it across, in particular, the Northeast and the eastern portion of the United States of America, east of the Mississippi. Portions of this great country that were flourishing in the 50s are today wastelands. In part because of all this. And instead of really addressing the underlying issues, what we did, unfortunately, is we papered them over. We allowed people to borrow more and more and more money. We had the first bubble in internet bubble in 2000, 2001 timeframe. We didn't learn anything from that. We continued borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. Then we had the near collapse in 2009. We didn't learn our lessons then either. And so now we find ourselves in a place where the American market, you know, we could bemoan all sorts of aspects of our history, but on an economic basis, American consumers are the most vibrant group of consumers on earth. It's gigantic purchases every year. You cannot be in a global business without serving the American market. So, you know, we're in decent shape. On the other hand, in China, China does not have, they started on this course really in 89. They didn't have then the stock of financial wealth that we had in 1989. They didn't have the expertise, the natural training and business that we had built up. And they just decided, and the corporate-owned media, because it needed the Chinese market, they thought, decided to embrace the view that America was the declining power and China was the rising power. So there ensued a vast amount of spending inside China on ghost towns, ghost manufacturing projects, corruption, some good projects, but the idea that the Chinese market, the consumer market, is anywhere near the U.S. market today is belied by facts that you can see in UNCTAD's database that goes back to 1970 for all countries in the world showing just that. What does each country consume? What do they invest? What do they export? What do they import? So the first major shock is this Chinese miracle. They did what we did in the 87, 89 timeframe in the 2000, only they did it to a much greater extent. They way overinvested in projects that are not going to get repaid properly, going to lose money, should lose money for the people who put the money up. So they have that problem. Europe has the problem that they thought they could be better than the United States by getting into this EU, which is really another big bloated bureaucracy on top of all the other bloated national bureaucracies inside Europe. And with England's departure, other countries are going to leave the EU. That experiment doesn't look like it's going so well. So there you have the three biggest pieces of the global economy. The United States is still okay, China in deep trouble, and Europe, I would say, also in trouble. Then you layer on the coronavirus panic, and speculators and markets are driven by today not so much individuals but by algorithms, and people make money in volatile markets. Traders are very happy to see big up and down moves. So the coronavirus, I'm not a medical person, and I do feel I'm a numbers person, and I just would encourage people to understand that the number of flu deaths, normal standard flu that we don't go into a panic about in this country, are anywhere from 20 to 60,000 a year. And so the number so far of coronavirus deaths are low, but people are obviously concerned about it. I'm actually sitting in a place right now that's not far away from where somebody here in New York was diagnosed with having coronavirus. So we all are worried about this kind of stuff. But I think that bit of it, I agree with some other commentators. I think the bigger issue is slowing global demand, as measured in, you see slowing demand for oil before Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia decided to get into a supply war, really, with Russia, driving prices down. Even before that recent move over the weekend, lowering prices, flooding supply, even before then, there were many signs in of slowing demand for this gigantic commodity that we all buy, oil and related commodities, natural gas. You saw slowing activity in shipping. So you see many signs around the world of a slowdown coming. And it's not one individual's fault here. I mean, Donald Trump may happen to be president of the United States, but what we're doing now, if we do have further correction, is we're just going to reap the results of, I think, many years, if not decades, of malinvestment, of people believing that just because some politician can announce a big dig in Boston that it's a good idea. I mean, it's not necessarily a good idea. We have blown a tremendous amount of money on wasteful projects, and we're not really addressing the underlying issue, which is that the set of incentives today, even today, favor an employer getting rid of an employee over hiring new employees. We have an anti-employment bias built into the tax system, built into just the business practices inside this country. And we could change that. We should change that. And it's not a Democrat or Republican issue. It makes a lot more sense to encourage people to employ other people productively than it does to put people in positions where they see no hope and they become dependent on a bloated government that's not responsive to the people anyway.
Could you get closer to the specific thing that set off all these buzzers? And that is a face-off between Saudi Arabia and Russia, and also involving the United States. What was that all about?
Well, so what has happened is, I mean, it's really the face-off is actually between is Saudi Arabia and to a certain extent Russia against the U.S. In the last, I would say, decade or so, the United States policy has favored production of available oil reserves coming out of shale, and America has gone from being a net importer of oil to a net exporter of oil. Now, these shale projects are more expensive to get the oil out of the ground than getting oil out of Saudi Arabia, which has a very low lifting cost. So there is one school of thought that Saudi Arabia has made this move now, not simply to punish or to rebalance the oil market to put the shale production out of competitive range, but also to go after Iran, which is, of course, a rival energy producer as well that's flat on its feet. So I think there is certainly across, you look at some of the great names in the oil and gas sector, whether they're oil energy producers or oil servicing firms. I mean, these stock prices have been destroyed this week. I mean, the sum of down 50% a day. So there's a major, I'd say, a tactical battle going on there. But even before the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia encouraged this move, even before then, there were signs that the Chinese market was dramatically cooling, if not reversing into negative growth decline. And the Chinese are voracious purchasers of oil and gas. They don't have large internal supplies. So, if the Chinese engine continues to slow, then you're going to see far less demand for oil and natural gas, just at the same time as MBS and the Russians have decided to increase supplies. So it's an unusual, this kind of stuff doesn't happen, thankfully, every day of the week.
Just so people listening should know, you can call 888-874-4888 to ask Charles a question about what we experienced, what we are experiencing so far this week. So, Charles, is there going to be, or is it possible that because people aren't talking and they're not negotiating as they used to in the old days, is it inevitable that there will be some kind of war?
Such is the nature of mankind. The history of mankind so far is there's a constant state of war. If you think about it, I can't think of a period where there hasn't been some kind of armed conflict going on somewhere in the world. And so, let's hope that we're talking about places in the world where the opposing armies are not using nuclear weapons. But I think in the United States, we've got to get through this election, and we'll see what happens in November, assuming, I don't know if you noticed this, Eutrice, but just moments ago, Harvard and Amherst, Harvard well-known, Amherst less well-known, both announced that they are suspending in-person classes for the balance of the school year through May, June. So, if they do it, you can be sure that many other universities are going to suspend, depending on how this virus does play. You could imagine a scenario where people would agitate against holding large meetings and against even possibly holding an election. So, this could be a very unusual election season here in 2020. But I don't believe there's any compromise possible between the current House and the Senate Democrats in this administration. I don't think, on significant issues, I see no possibility of a compromise through the election, but I could be wrong.
Nathaniel, you're on the air with Charles Ortel. Ortel.
Greetings, Trees. Okay. Thank you. Greetings to you and the PRN audience, as well as Charles Ortel. I have a question.
Ortel, O-R-T-E-L.
Ortel, yes.
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 What's your question?
My question is, I'll just go ahead and ask it. I'm not sure if it's a great question. What effect does Charles think that all these sanctions against the countries in the Middle East, the Russia and South America is having on the world economy and the U.S. economy?
Well, I think that we have to pick apart the different sanctions. So I think that the ones in Iran, I think back to 2009, and I just happen to have many friends from Iran, and it's a tragedy to see what is going on in that country and in the diaspora of Iranians. But we're dealing, I think, with a thuggish regime there that has been engaged in actions that are hostile to the interests of the American people and the economy. And so those sanctions, to me, make a lot of sense. Venezuela, I think they make a lot of sense. Russia, I really wish that it were possible to have productive discussions with that country, because I draw it as a big distinction between Russia and China. I think Russia with 150 million odd people versus China with 1.4 billion. Is a nation that if we could get into a productive economic relationship, that is to say Europe and Russia and the United States, then we may not need to have a NATO to the same degree. We may not need to spend as much money. And to me, it's just a crying shame that we're in a place now where the only way we can proceed with them is through sanctions. I'm sure I'm leaving out North Korea, and it's a miracle to me that we accord so much attention to that tiny country and tiny economy. Perhaps I've left out a few other countries that we're sanctioning. I do it just because I can't remember them off the top of my head.
Oh, yes, that's fine. I was wondering, I know the different issues are at hand for each country, but I was more curious about what monetary or trade or economic effect on the global economy do you think that these, could you put a number on it, that these sanctions are having for the United States and Europe?
Well, So for the United States, when we look at the United States economy, what I focus upon is the consumption economy and the investment economy. So yeah, not exports, not imports, just consumption and investment inside this country. Our economy is so big relative to a North Korea or Russia or Venezuela, I don't think they're having major league impact one way or another economically on us. And it's just the numbers are staggering. I'd encourage you to look at this UNCTAD database. It's just amazing how big our economy is. So when we take an action like this, it's not like we're heavily dependent on Iran or North Korea or any of these countries for any imported goods. So we're not driving up prices of things we urgently need. And it's not like the economy is in question or we're buying or we'll likely buy a lot of American goods in the short term. So I don't really think it's having much of an impact.
Thank you, Nathaniel, for your questions. Tony from Orlando, you're on the air with Charles Ortel.
Hi, Trees. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
Hi, Trees.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling in.
I had a question for Charles.
So ask him. He's right here. He's with us.
Hi, Charles.
Hi there. How are you?
Alrighty, I'm doing fine. I had a question in regards to Wall Street. It seems as if Wall Street is asking for a fiscal stimulus package. Given this administration and the House's inability to come together, like you said, before the election in any meaningful way, do you think are they going to be able to provide a meaningful stimulus package to satisfy Wall Street in order to prevent us from sliding into a possible recession?
I think the history of these stimulus packages is not good. If we go back to the Obama era, which is the last huge one, if you'll remember, the former chairman and chief executive officer of General Electric and Barack Obama joked after the fact about, for all the talk of shovel-ready jobs that supposedly were going to be the basis of, you know, why we needed all this money, that there were, in fact, no shovel-ready jobs. There were very few jobs created by a stimulus that approached $1 trillion. Now they're talking about $350 billion. I just don't see that as a smart way to go. Again, the way I would like to see us try to fix this problem is to make it incentivize people to actually come up with and pay for good jobs for people. We don't do that. We make it very difficult to hire somebody today and to keep them online. And I think if we could reverse course and think more deeply and creatively about how to encourage employment, how to encourage not just phony make-work jobs, but real jobs, how to encourage people to save money and invest money, that would turbocharge this economy if you went down that path. I'm not in favor of a Wall Street bailout. I'm certainly not in favor of an investor bailout. We live in a global marketplace, and because other parts of the world are in much worse shape than we are, because our treasury market, our debt market is so large and deep, what you've seen in the last 7 days is a flood of capital coming into this economy, pushing our interest rates down even further. So that's, on the one hand, it's a good sign because it means people have confidence in our economy, but on the bad end of it, it props up artificially high certain stock prices. So again, this is not a problem that will be solved with $1 trillion stimulus. It's not a problem that certainly won't be solved with $350 billion. And I question whether it makes any sense to pile more debt to the level needed in this economy to try to solve a problem which extends to China, extends to India, extends across Europe. It's not simply a U.S. problem.
That seems like a pretty good answer from you, but it seems as if Wall Street's asking for a fiscal stimulus aid.
I'm having difficulty hearing.
Yeah, Could you speak a little louder, Tony?
I'm sorry?
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, but it's still muffled.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
It just seems as if Wall Street's been asking for some sort of fiscal stimulus, whether it's coordinated between all the major countries or just at least with the United States, given the fact that it seems as if this virus is causing a lot of businesses to slow down and a lot of events being canceled and forcing some people to self-quarantine and not be able to go to work, and many people might lose their jobs because of it. So it seems as if Wall Street, in the short term, is trying to get ahead of what the earnings reports are going to come showing us months down the road, that the economy did slow down a bit, and that being that this is a consumer-driven economy, we might possibly go into some sort of slowdown or recession. So it seems as if Wall Street's trying to get ahead of that. And that, I mean, like, I believe last week the Federal Reserve, they cut the interest rate by a half a percentage point, and it seemed as if Wall Street reacted negatively to that cut, basically signaling that they want something more than a rate cut, but more of a fiscal stimulus.
Yeah. So I'm afraid I only got a portion of what you just said, but I think what you're asking is, do I think there's going to be a coordinated attempt by the major governments around the world to lower interest rates and, in theory, prop up the markets to get ahead of the coronavirus impact? So I am dubious at this moment about the degree to which the coronavirus alone is a factor in the slowdown that we've seen in the last several days in the market. But over time, in the last several months, particularly in large places like China. So I think what I'm hearing are pushes for what really sound to me like gimmicks. And I'm against gimmicks. We're here now in a place where the 10-year interest rate, which until December 2008, the average 10-year interest rate in the United States of America from, I think it was 1972 or thereabouts, to 2008 was above 5%. We're down at 50 basis points, so one-tenth of that. And, you know, we have problems. We have severe problems. I don't think it makes sense to have negative interest rates. I think we are, instead of addressing the core of the issues, and I've written a 10-part series that's up on my website, www.charlesortel.com, that takes you through specifically what I believe was wrong with the U.S. economy in 2000. I published it originally, I think, in 2014 or 16, I forget which, but it's up there on my site. There are structural problems that need to be addressed. These problems are denominated in the trillions of dollars. They don't involve artificially suppressing interest rates. They don't involve continuing to have a government that spends much more than it earns. They're, you know, heavy lifting projects that need to be examined. People will disagree with some of my ideas. People may like some of the ideas. People can improve the ideas. But trying to just react to this problem, which really hasn't fully materialized yet, strikes me as a headlong rush down the wrong way.
Thanks, Tony, for your question. Gwen from New York, you're on the air with Charles Ortel.
Hi, I just wanted to ask a question. Charles, do you think that if Bernie Sanders were to become the nominee, that he would destroy Wall Street? Because I heard Joe Biden say this morning that he would do everything he could to protect Wall Street, including hire Jamie Dimon.
Yeah, I am an independent who, past I've voted mostly for Republicans, and so I'm not really a Democrat, and I, you know, any advice I might give to Democrats could be viewed as gratuitous. But I mean, isn't it a shame that after all of these events, all these private jets flying around and contributing to environmental problems and all these large crowds that the best we have on the Democratic side is two people who are pushing 80 years old, one who isn't even a Democrat, another who, I mean, I pity, frankly, Joe Biden at this stage. I mean, today he had another rambling discussion with attacking somebody who was criticizing him in a public setting. And I don't think anybody, any single individual, will actually be successful in crushing a vibrant market, set of markets that are characterized as being Wall Street. I don't think that's possible. But I do think that some of Bernie's plans are, you know, they're just, there's no dimensions around them. To say that he doesn't really understand the price tag for some of these ideas, but we've got to do it anyway, that's just foolish talk. And that being said, I think that Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden and others, and Tulsi Gabbard, for that matter, who's still in the Democratic process, should have a chance to really address one another in a public setting and get right into the areas where they agree and disagree. And I then will look forward to seeing whatever debates may ensue between Donald Trump and the winner.
Okay.
We have a follow-up. Thank you. Okay, thanks for calling in. Lincoln from Mount Vernon, you're on the air with Charles Ortel.
Hi, good day. How are you?
I am
okay. Mr. Ortel. I actually respect your work, Mr. Ortel, but I want to know, you referred to, in answering the previous callers, the fellow before this lady, you, in reference to the sanctions, don't you think that you have to respond to the sanctions, especially about Iran, in terms of history? Like you referred to Iran as a thuggish government. Iran is not as thuggish as America. And the U.S. rules the world by military might, not by economics. Military might is what rules the world. And military might is what determines economics. Because money on
some level is... What is the question? The question, Lincoln, please. Let's have a question.
I wanted to pose a question in that sense, and wanted him to respond to it, because what grabbed me was when he referred to Iran as a thuggish government, and I think it's disingenuous that there's no bigger thug than the USA. And he also referred to
a critique instead of a question. I like questions. Do you have a question? Please.
I'd like for him to respond to what I said.
Yeah, but what you said was not a question.
I could try, Idris.
Okay.
I'm happy to try.
Fine.
So I think that, you know, when I wrote a column in 2009 in the Washington Times, about the process in 2009. I don't think I was writing yet for the Washington Times, but I wrote about what happened then when that poor young lady, Neda, and others in Iran were rising up against the corrupt regime there, that when you get into the details, truly is siphoning money away from the people in a project that has been an economic disaster for a generation of Iranians. Now, Americans are not blameless when it comes to Iran. We have, embraced the Shah. We, going way back into history, we deposed Mossadegh. We hardly have covered ourselves in glory in Iran, and I'm not trying to argue that we did. But the current regime, it has, some argue that the election of 2009 was corrupt. Many argue that the regime has been siphoning money away from the people corruptly. I have made that case on Iranian television myself. I do it regularly. The people of Iran, I would argue, are locked down under a regime that is destroying them. Now, is it America's responsibility to do anything about that? Some would argue no. But to compare ourselves to Iran, in this country, we are a multicultural country. My ancestors came here from Germany and Portugal. decades ago, and many, many examples of people from all walks of life have come into this country and flourished. Are we perfect? No. No country is perfect. But on a spectrum, you can actually, you want to roll up your sleeves and make a contribution in this society, anywhere in this country, you can do it. Not so if you're a Christian in Iran. Not so if you're a Jew in Iran. Not so if you are a Sunni Muslim in Iran. And our country, it is a wealthy country with a large economy. Our military is expensive, but we can afford it. Iran can certainly not afford the military adventurism that it's been practicing around the world. So, no, I don't think we're a thug. And, yes, I do say, double down, that it's a thuggish regime.
Thanks, Lincoln, for your question. E from Edgewater, you have the last question, but not unlimited time.
Good day, Charles.
Hi.
My question is, from previous shows that you were on, you always mentioned that the Clinton a certain date that they had to comply with to release disclosures, something to do with the foundation. And if they didn't come through with that, then there was going to be indictments set up for them. Did anything ever happen with that? Because I haven't heard any indictments for the Clintons, and I think they should get their just desserts.
Right. What you're referring to is that all charities have to file what are called either PF forms if it's a private foundation or 990s if it's a charity. And those are typically due the final filing deadline on a calendar entity are November 15th. And the answer to your question is they have filed many defective, incorrect, false, and materially misleading filings, which compounds their legal exposure, assuming prosecutions actually happen. And in this country, you're innocent until proven guilty. So if there's a prosecution ongoing, you may or may not know about it. I am not privy to whether there are, nor should I be privy to whether there are any grand jury proceedings. But I can say that I believe there are investigations ongoing around the world, many different ways, against many foundations connected to the Clinton Foundation, part of the Clinton Foundation, against accounting firms, against potential donors, actual donors. There are many such things moving along, and I think the challenge for people is whether they want to really go and try to discipline the whole thing, or whether they just want to take small pieces of it and let the politically prominent people skate. That, I think, is the balance going on right now. And in the fullness of time, we shall soon see what really will happen.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Well, Charles, that brings us to the end of our program today, but I know you are occupied, super occupied, with proceeding with your investigations. So we will talk and see when next we can get together. But I want to thank you so much for today, for giving us a nice backdrop to the craziness we saw this week on Wall Street. It was very imperative, I think, that we understand things that are not readily reported or readily seen, that we also should have an appreciation of what is happening behind the scenes or has happened behind the scenes. So thank you so much. And thank you for your work. So you will hear from me, and we'll figure out when next we can get together.
Thank you so much, Eutrice. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Well, that brings us to the end of the program. As I said, today is Super Tuesday in six states. Results will not be in until later this evening, but certainly by tomorrow morning, we'll have a look at what transpired today. See you. Bye-bye.